friends, welcome to episode 12 of Chris Chambers Noir. This month we shine a light on Aggie Blum Thompson, whose book You Deserve to Know is being turned into a TV series on Hulu. That is super cool. I can't wait to hear all about it. I'm Hope Katz Gibbs, proud producer of the show on ChrisChambersNoir.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Incandescent TV, and Incandescent Radio. So take it away, Chris.
Yes, thank you, Hope. I am so happy to have Aggie today. And yes, we are on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Incandescent Radio Network. And these are the same folks who bring you Elaine's Literary Salon here in the nation's capital, in the national capital area. I have to shout out to my my boy, Terrell Ventura, son of Jesse, the body, the governor of Minnesota, Ventura. He's also a fellow podcaster. It's his birthday, and he usually begins his podcast greetings and salutations. So that's my shout out to Tyrell today. So again, we have the Duchess, the Diva, the Dean of Domestic Suspense, Aggie Blum Thompson. And, you know, and in all seriousness, I mean, this is a now a pillar of our crime fiction genre, of which, you know, there were originally just three. There was police procedurals, cozies, and hard boiled. And now there are many. And this is a foundational kind of subgenre. And, you know, it's good that we have someone of Aggie's stature here, you know, in that regard, because this is where our crime fiction genre was invented by Mr. Poe here in the DMV 200 years ago or thereabouts. And, you know, of course, we are, Aggie and I are fellow members of Mystery Writers of America, of which Mr. Edgar Allan Poe is our logo. And if my bride gets in time, I'll nominate you for one, for an award. How about that? But Aggie, we have we usually do a kind of icebreaker, and then I jump into something more serious and academic. But my icebreaker is this, and I'm just going to tell a story. Okay, I was meeting a bunch of writers. This is like bestseller writing people in Virginia, and somebody said, another best-selling, you know, author said, "Oh, Aggie Blum Thompson's going to join us," and I'm like, "Oh, okay, Aggie Blum Thompson, fine." So we go out to this bar, and Aggie, you know, walks in, and I'm thinking, okay, all right, this is like, what? This is another housewife writing about, you know, housewives in trouble again, and blah 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 blah, you know. So total, you know, book and cover judging, you know, faux pas. I could not have been more effing wrong. Okay, I'm not just about the work, but, you know, which is one thing, but I mean, just about Aggie. And, you know, Aggie, you know, first I knew she was a journalist. That wasn't the thing, but I was like, oh, okay. She's coming in from Bethesda with her purse and her soccer mom stories. And no. So, I mean, you grew up in Long Island, and you were a bartender. Just go into that for a little while, just to give us a taste of what you did, because you were tending bar in Midtown. You were doing all kinds of stuff back in the day. What was that like?
Well, I was a classic underachiever. I graduated college and I didn't really, I was writing a novel. I thought I would actually be able to sell it. I was a bartender at that time. I worked at several bars, but the one you're referring to is this really shitty Mexican restaurant called Minidito. It was on 8th Avenue and in the 50th. And it was on the weekends, sometimes the Rockettes would come in. It was right near Broadway. We get a lot of the Broadway crew to come in. It was a big hangout for the cops from Midtown South. And I lived in Hell's Kitchen at the time. This is in the 90s. So not the Hell's Kitchen of today.
Right.
So like right when Giuliani was coming in, and just not to get too deep New York, but there's this big change when Giuliani came in, and he kind of made like dancing in bars illegal. You had to have a cabaret license. So this was his way of like shutting things down. And there was just this whole vibe that he was trying to clean up. And Times Square was really, really bad. I grew up in New York and on Long Island, but you know, my parents grew up in the city. My dad grew up in New York City, his grandparents, my grandparents. And Times Square was terrible, obviously, in the 70s. But even up through the late 80s, it was still like a lot of teenage prostitution. It was Porn Central, live porn shows. It was almost getting worse in a way because they kept having to up their ante to make Times Square attractive to people. So they really crazy lives.
Hey, I was a customer. I was a young man. I'd come into the city. You know, if I'm not downtown, I'm in Times Square.
Yeah, but as like porn became more available, Times Square had to keep upping its ante to get people to come. And so I was living there in the early 90s and it was just starting to turn. They were doing that deal with Disney to kind of clean things up. So I worked at this, one of the places I worked was as a bartender. I'm at Miedito and trying to sell my first novel, which I never sold. It was in a drawer somewhere. And then I went on to become a reporter. My first job was as a cops reporter in the South in a town called Wilmington, North Carolina. It's a small city. That's where like Cape Fear was based. That was a really interesting experience. You know, I'm like a New York Jew in the South going showing up at crime scenes. And I never experienced the South. I didn't know anything about the South. Friendliest people to your face, really, really, really friendly. There were dynamics there that I wasn't used to coming from New York. There was a lot of crime. I don't know if it's still like that in Wilmington, but at the time they had pretty high homicide rate. Wilmington's where Michael Jordan grew up, by the way.
Right.
And you know, it has its own really dark history. Maybe, do you know about this, Chris, about like the white picket fence driving?
So
it's got its own racial,
Totally.
It's got its own racial reckoning history that's like never quite been healed. And so that was really interesting. And then I went and worked in Virginia and then up in Boston and then DC. I covered the DC sniper trial, the younger of the two men, Lee Boy Malvo. He was the teenager.
Right.
And that was down in Virginia, in Tidewater, Virginia, his trial. So yeah. So my background is in police reporting, not in soccer momming.
Right. I tell this story to people because it was like getting hit with a bucket of cold water because I was like, like I said, you waltzed in, you know, and you're like, hi, and everything. And I said, all right, I got her pegged. And I was like, no. And, you know, it's always a pleasure, you know, just kind of talking to you. Just off the cuff as people, not, you know, shop talk, because, you know, you've got this background, you've got all these, you know, these personal stories and narratives and, you know, that fits, you know, what we're trying to, you know, talk about today, because, you know, I did it on purpose, kind of on episode 11. We had Todd Robinson, Big Daddy Thug from downtown, from the Village. And Rob Hart talking about the, you know, the decline and then the resurgence of hard boiled noir. And it's a good bookend for you because, you know, there's this popular notion out there, you know, I don't know, maybe it's from the readers, I don't know, maybe some authors and some agents and publishers put this out that, you know, the minute that Gone Girl and The Girl on the Train came out, hard boiled noir took the dive, kind of like, you know, the minute Kurt Cobain came out, hard hair bands disappeared.
Right.
You know, and you were probably a hair band fan at some point, right? Did you put on makeup?
I was a little more of a New Order, English Beat kind of fan than a hair band.
All right.
Yeah.
Fair enough. But, you know, so there's this notion that happened, and that's not really the case. And indeed, these, you know, the subgenres are not
But Chris, there has been this shift, and I think, like, if we're going to be totally frank, why not?
Yeah.
Right. No.
Oh yeah.
It's determined by who runs publishing, who the agents are, who the editors are, and who the most vocal active readership are.
Right
and
it's women
tick
off all those categories.
And it's a particular kind of woman. Right. It's a millennial woman, usually.
Right.
It's usually a white woman. It's usually it's a very particular kind of person with a very particular aesthetic.
Right.
And the thing about my books, the reason I like suburban noir to describe my books is the noir world is a world that's screwed up. Something happens, but order is not restored in the world at the end. At the end, you survived, but the world goes on as it was before, this corrupt world. And that is different from a lot of books where order is restored to a good world, right? Like right. There's the outlook, we have a good world and someone bad came in and did a bad thing. We arrested them, took care of them, and now good order is restored. And that's not my vibe right, in the yeah. books. Right. Well, I think that there is this real movement right now for books to feel like a big warm hug. There's this real push that we want to feel good, that people want to feel, or women readers want to feel good after books. And that's not going to happen when you read noir.
Right. Yeah. And this is a perfect segue because I want to ask you this. This is my little one of my little academic questions. This is a we'll be reversed on YouTube. Don't worry, but we're just talking on the digital radio now. But I'm on page 342, right at the end of your novel, All the Dirty Secrets.
Wow.
Aptly titled. And I'm right here, literally at the end. I just want to read you something. And if you could, analyze it in terms of what you just said about noir and domestic noir. And here's it right at the end. And it's Zoe, the daughter, texting, Liza, her mom. I don't have to tell you, you invented them. I can't help but grin. Zoe knows I'm nervous. That it's everything I can do just to let her leave our apartment in the morning. But where there is no trust, there can be no love. Sounds good, I type. I trust you. Now, is that, given what you just said, though, is that the one thing where there's at least this hope of an equilibrium of love and trust that does kind of separate domestic noir from hard-boiled noir? Because you could say in hard-boiled noir, trust is totally transactional and love is something yes. that other people have. Is that the one thing that what you have that separates it from, say, somebody like Pelicano's?
Yeah, I think that domestic means domestic relationships. Right. So relationships are at the heart of domestic noir. They're really a relationship between a mother and a daughter, a husband and a wife, friends, whatever. And that's the core of domestic suspense is what happens vis-a-vis these relationships over the book. And do they survive? And who does it turn out you can trust? And yeah, you do kind of have to have something to hope for at the end. But I'm curious what you thought of that book. That's my most DC book.
I loved it. I mean, that was, I mean, I have the other ones, but this is, I bought this specifically because I didn't yeah. have it. And I wanted to get into it because it is, the most, DC, not just in terms of setting, and the area being a character, but, it is domestic noir. I mean, and it was really, I thought that was really cool. And not to give anything away. I mean, I have in my latest trilogy, now going to be a quadrilogy, I guess. One of the ongoing themes is, the character had a sister who was kind of on the outsider. She was an African-American woman that wanted to go on kind of beach week stuff. Right. And she was, raped.
Oh, wow.
And her brother, that character, when they were younger, got one of his friends, who was a drug dealer, to go out and kill these preppies.
That's like a twin book to my book, basically.
Right. But so it's subtext and it's a sub story, but even that, on that level, I was like, wow, yeah, this is a real DC book. This is a real, if you're going to have that label and move that needle to domestic noir, right, rather than domestic suspense, this is it, and I was really, and that's why I wanted to ask you about that one line at the end, because yeah. it was consistent with what some of my friends are doing in our subgenre until that end where it just, there was just, yes, there's that relationship. So it's got to end on that kind of a hopeful thing. And, you know, and it can be simple as that. There are people who probably write Crime Reads articles on this, but, you know, why should you when it's that simple? Because you just summarized it. You have longstanding relationships in this subgenre that get effed up. We can actually say fuck on this, by the way, if you're so inclined. right, there you go. So there's the Long Island girl coming out. But you know, you got these longstanding.
The Long Island way is fuck.
Fuck. So there you go. But it's but with most hard-boiled noir, you don't have that, and that's one reason why it's hard-boiled noir, because there's a lack of these relationships.
So I think in the domestic suspense world, there is domestic suspense that's really light. There are books out there where the characters are really vanilla. And by that, I mean, you don't know really a lot about them. You don't know where they live. You don't know what their jobs are. You don't know what ethnicity they are. They're just sort of stand-ins for men or stand-ins for women.
Right.
And stand-in for husband, stand-in for wife. And they could be anywhere suburbia. And, you know, it's just about this sort of hypothetical, if a wife did this thing to a husband, right? And then on the other end, you have real specificity. You have people who are writing about real people in real places.
Right.
And that end of it, I think, is more adjacent to what you're talking about,
right,
where it feels like it's affecting real lives. But it's a real range out there of what domestic suspense is.
Oh, yeah. And well, this is going to be my next question. Now, you've got Karen in one book and Liza in another. They seem to be more aligned to that part of domestic suspense where you really have true, how can I put this? I have it written down in my notes. True amateur sleuths in deep shit. Is that pretty accurate?
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
as crass as I can put it. Amateur sleuths in deep shit. Yet with some of the other books, you don't really have that. It's more of a psychological. I mean, did you plan that to try to show a kind of panoply of kind of what you can do? Or is it just happened that way? And you just, you know, I'm going to concentrate on these women as they're in deep trouble. They're deep secrets.
Yeah.
They got to get themselves out. But the other books, it's more, the atmosphere is more psychological. Let's hear a little bit about that.
I think I do try to write something a little different with every book, like take on a different tone or a different subject. I don't want to go over the same material over and over again. My first book is An Ordinary Woman Who's in Really, Really Deep Shit. I Don't Forgive You. The book that kind of isn't like that is Such a Lovely Family.
Right.
Which is a lighter, kind of campier, knives out book. I wrote that book the year my mom was dying and then died. I just didn't have the emotional reserves to write that other kind of book. I needed to write something a little lighter and a little less intense because of what I was going through. I just didn't want to go through it on the page too, because I was going through it in real life.
And then you came roaring back.
Right. Yeah. I mean, what I try to do, except for Such a Lovely Family, is different. But the other books, what I try to do is I try to have a really ordinary, basic mom. And like you said, she gets in really deep shit. Like none of my characters are like former assassins or former FBI you know, former weather.
I was going to say, I mean, that was going to be my next question. I mean, did you avoid that on purpose?
Yes. Okay. I really wanted women to feel like they identified with these women when they first started the book. Like, this could have happened to you. That's the feeling I wanted people to have. You could be going to a graduation party and then you get drugged and you pass out, or you could get a phone call that your daughter got in trouble at the beach, or you know, these things could happen to you. So sometimes I read the back of a book and it says like, oh, you know, former hired, you know, kill for hire assassin Susanna has moved into, and already I'm like, I'm out. Like, that's not, I just doesn't feel realistic to me. I don't relate to it. Maybe it could be fun, but I want you to feel like this could be your life, basically.
Well, you also, maybe it's a trope or something, you know, on that lighter end of domestic suspense, you also don't have a lot of weird kind of sidekicky characters. I mean, you know, which is, you know, when you look at the flip side of domestic suspense, it's domestic comedy. You know, it's a movie coming out now with Leslie Mann called Spa Weekend or something. There's always these sidekicky women,
right?
You know, and you do see that, and when you go back into crime, I mean, you avoid that too. If I make you
get to know a character, 99% of the time they are deeply involved with the plot. There's some reason that they're there. And I probably shouldn't say that because it gives it away. If I've made you meet them and know their name, they're going to have some role in this.
Well, that was going to be my next thing. I mean, you know, that's what sets your books apart, because there are many of these books that have kind of sidekicky characters, because perhaps the protagonist just doesn't have it in her, you know, to really kind of save herself or save whoever. Right. They need whoever the support staff is to kind of come in, the BFF, you know, or the BFF, you know, is about to save her and then gets killed by the evil husband or something like that. And that's, you know, and you know, you avoid that.
I never want to do the evil husband. It's almost never the evil husband. Maybe someone else's evil husband. That's not maybe your evil husband.
right. Well, and that's the other thing. I mean, I'm you know, thank you for moving my outline along. The other tropes, it seems to be that the husband is either evil or just a total moron, and just doesn't see what's going on, doesn't feel what's going on. You know, has no. I mean, even if you're talking about in the same household, a mother and a daughter, you know, sharing something. Where did that come from? I mean, is that something that to fulfill some psychic need of the reader base?
It's like the call is coming from inside the house. I think that's what it's based on, is like the person you've pledged to share everything with, that you're the most vulnerable with, is actually the person undoing your life. And when it's done well, it's phenomenal, right? What's that book, While I Was Sleeping? Is that what it was called? About the woman who wakes up, right? Exactly. And every morning she has amnesia and she has to write. Like, that's phenomenal. I won't give away it's about whether it's her husband. But when it's done really well, it's really good. It's just, it can, like anything else, it can become a cliche if you just lean onto that, right?
But, you know, and I totally understand. And that was, and again, I'm glad you brought that up, because that was what I wanted you to emphasize. But at the same time, There is an element where the husband or the male character, who's, you know, this woman's supposed to really lean on, you know, isn't part of the problem, but just some dullard, you know, or he's the reason why, you know, his inattention, you know, just generally, you know, I mean, I don't know whether it's lack of affection or just, you know, kind of 7-year itch or whatever, you know, is why she's kind of yearning to do other things in the first place. And, you know, and I'm not trying to say it's reverse sexism. I'm just saying it just seems to be funny to me that men are so much more complex than that. And, you know, and I think they'd probably make better.
I'll take your word for it.
I mean, here's the thing. I'm just saying we make better antagonists than we do just kind of set these dullards.
I think you're getting at something here, which is domestic suspense is really about women and their relationships to other women and their relationships to their own power and to what's going on in the world. And men have to be sort of, in many of these books, neutralized in a way so that we can see kind of what women would do, right?
Right.
I mean, and also the flip side would be like the femme fatale in noir books. Like, exactly. Why are all the women, right? It's just a way of sort of putting the other sex over here for a moment and seeing how these people behave.
Yeah, there's you know, you want to call it archetypes, and you could call them tropes too, of females in our subgenre. And, you know, you can see the evolution of it, but there are really two kinds. I mean, there's the femme fatale and then there's the Girl Friday. And that doesn't mean the Girl Friday is virginal and everything. It's just she's the cool one that you kind of do kind of depend on, but you don't want to depend on her. And she probably likes you. The femme fatale is what you're drawn to, and the Girl Friday.
I mean, like, do you read Robert Galbraith's books, J.K. Rowling? Yeah. So, I mean, there's literally, she started off as a Girl Friday. She starts off as the secretary,
Right.
The substitute secretary, and she becomes like the competent person, and but she has a thing for her, you know. It's so classic, right?
Yeah.
So that's kind of like the husband who's there, but he's not all there, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, but it's interesting though. I mean, as a man and as a writer too, just to see that juxtaposition between what you're used to and then in this subgenre, it's you know, like I said, I expect more of, you know, the husbands to be just, you know, murderers or just kind of in cahoots with what's going on, or the prime gaslighters. But
yeah, I love gaslighting.
Well, let's explore that. I mean, your characters in some of these books tend to gaslight themselves, it seems.
Yeah. Don't we all, though, Chris?
Yeah. That's true, but I mean,
because I think it's the modern experience, is especially in 2026, to go outside and say, "Is this really happening? Wait, is this reality? Am I overreacting, or have things really turned a corner and now we're like in cuckoo land?" Like, it happens all the time, I think, to people on these little tiny levels, and that anxiety. I mean, even in just domestic life, the kids, your in-laws. You know, your mother-in-law calls you, you know, was she being passive aggressive? Is she annoyed with me? Am I reading into that? What's going on about this Thanksgiving dinner? Like, it's just a kind of a, I think, a part of modern life. And so I like to really lean into that, because I think people do question their own judgment all the time.
What do you think, especially when we're talking about Karen and Liza, that they kind of they tend to overreact to stuff they probably should be cool about and underreact to the monster that's like right behind them. I mean, what is that? I mean, that's not a character flaw. I mean, it is being human, but at the same time, I mean, flipping back to, if we're talking about men and women, is that something that, you know, women tend to do? And that's something you can examine as an author. I mean,
I think that's a mom thing. I mean, I really do. I think women, you know, as soon as they have kids, are primed to be scanning for threat. Right. And the threat could be a form that was supposed to be turned in last week that you didn't turn in, and now you're going to be yelled at. Or the threat could be, oh, I didn't get the right back to school stuff for my kids. Or the threat could be, oh, I'm supposed to be organizing this birthday party. Or it could be something bigger, like my kid has a peanut allergy. I have to make sure that everywhere they go, they have their EpiPen. It's this constant anxiety that you live with, that this never-ending to-do list, this constant scanning. My kids are both leaving for college this fall, and you know, I'm really happy for them, and I'm really happy for me, because I feel like I can finally exhale, because you're on all the time when you're a mom,
right,
in a way that, I mean, I think most people acknowledge at this point that men don't necessarily carry, fathers don't necessarily carry that same anxious to-do list with them the way women do. So if you put in something in your neighborhood happening, like someone getting murdered, or something starts happening, you can see how that type of brain could really run with it and go with it.
Yeah, I was about to ask in that regard. I mean, do the worst fears of you know, of all these protagonists, you know, even in the lighter book, is the genesis of that the kind of mom, kid kind of a thing, or is it something external? It's internal.
It's always what's going on in my neighborhood. Like, I wrote the Beach Week book the year before my oldest was going to head off senior year, and she was talking about Beach Week. I wrote The Neighbors Are Watching when my oldest was applying to college, and I just heard nothing but college stuff around me, you know?
Well, let me ask you this then. I mean, I'm going to pick up on what you just said about your oldest going off to Beach Week.
She didn't go. She talked about it, but she didn't go. Yeah.
Well, is it? I mean, let's talk different cultures then. I mean, there's Beach Week here in the DMV, you know, of say upper middle class Beach Week, and then there's Beach Week, say, of Long Island, where people are going to.
There's no Beach Week on Long Island. There's no Beach Week in New York.
Jones Beach or anything,
You could go to Jones Beach whenever you want. And so when I moved down here and I heard about Beach Week, I thought that was insane. I was like, "What are you talking about? You pack up the kids with alcohol and send them off for a week? It seemed madness to me. I couldn't imagine."
You're right. There isn't anything analogous. I mean, I guess going to what, like the South Shore to Fire Island or the Hamptons or something, but they don't pack off whole high schools worth of people and go to the
Hamptons. Because you can go to the beach in an hour, right? Like, all throughout, right? I mean, I guess there is no equivalent, but we used to go in the city a lot on Long Island and get in trouble there, you know, but there's nothing like this with no parents for a full week. It's a pretty mid-Atlantic thing.
Well, what would you find, you know, I mean, as a mom or as a writer, you know, fertile ground for what's more, do you find that more terrorizing than, say, you lived in Long Island or Westchester and she just decided to get on the train and go down to Manhattan, just, you know, not disappear bad in a bad way, but disappear with her friends to get into trouble?
Yeah, I do. I mean, that was my life. I grew up, you know, going in the train starting in like eighth grade. And yeah, it was New York in the early 80s and it was pretty interesting. I got approached many times as a teenager in New York. But I think honestly, peers with alcohol is more dangerous. Like teenagers with alcohol is more dangerous than New York City, even in the early 80s.
Well, I mean, yeah, look at the Nolan Wells thing going on down in Mississippi now. I mean, that's that.
And with girls, I mean, it's really not safe. Yeah. You know, things used to happen at those big parties, right?
Just in your basement or down the street, you know. But it is interesting to me, though, that you know, we create this, I mean, even as whether you're a parent or a writer, you create this world where, yeah, getting on the Metro North train or the Long Island Railroad, going into Manhattan with a bunch of teenagers, that's the horror show. But you will come back from that, you know, probably with some stories. Right. But going to Rehoboth or Ocean City or Bethany with a bunch of people, I mean, people can end up in dumpsters or floating out to sea. But you don't, people pack off their kids merrily.
I know.
For that.
I know. Yeah, with alcohol in the trunk too.
Yeah, yeah. Is it, you know, is it a cultural thing where people, you know, and again, you know, going back to, you know, your present life there out there and, you know, the wonderful land of Bethesda's and everything are people deluding themselves out there maybe? And then thinking, you know, because I've seen these kids come down to my neighborhood and they go down to 14th Street and U Street and they think it's like Shangri-La. And I always kind of shake and say, be careful. But, you know, but the parents will tell them, look, be careful when you're on U Street. But don't be careful when you're, you know, down at on the Outer Banks with your supposed friends.
I don't know. I have to guess that it's how they grew up. So they think it's normal. I think some parents, I've was not this kind of parent, but I know I've heard a lot of parents say they're going to drink anyway. I might as well buy it for them so they don't have to drive somewhere when they're drunk. You know, there's all kinds of rationalizations and stuff.
Yeah. And again, that's grist for you. I mean, you know, is it easier? Checking off my outline here. So is it thus easier to come up with these horrific, you know, extensions of this stuff right there in your own neighborhood? I mean, you know, because all you have to do is just let your imagination go, right?
You know, yes. Here's the thing, Chris. It's like, this is what I'm writing right now is domestic suspense. I come up with a lot of ideas and I say, that's not a domestic suspense idea, right? Like I get a lot of ideas that maybe I could give to someone like you or someone who writes hard or crime, but I know my editor and I know it's not going to work with, right? Like I was a reporter at the Virginian Pilot when 9/11 happened. And that night I said, I want to go. Right. And I got in a car and I drove all night. And I had a really good friend who lived on the Lower East Side.
Virginia Beaches or Norfolk's?
Yeah, Norfolk,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then I got to New Jersey. I took a PATH train in and I walked down to my friend who lived on the Lower East Side. By the way, a block where my grandparents grew up.
Wow.
In the tenement building. Anyway, and that's before the NYPD had shut off Houston Street. They shut it off after that. So you couldn't go below Houston Street. And I was walking, I was at Ground Zero the next day, I had a mask on. It was unbelievable. And my job was to find someone from Hampton Roads or Tidewater, Virginia to justify my being there. Right. So I'm stopping every rescue worker, you know, everybody I know, trying to find someone so I could justify having taken this trip. And I found this guy. I found a guy who was from Norfolk, Virginia. And this black guy who was up there, he had been living in the Bronx. He'd heard about 9/11. He came down with his shovel and started,
wow,
you know, helping out. That's just the story of what New York was like back then. Everyone came down. It was unbelievable. Yeah. It's like thick ash everywhere over everything.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah.
And it smelled for, you know, that weird smell for months.
Weird smell. Totally wearing a mask, right? And like even the Korean bodegas were giving away water, which is the only thing about New York. You're like,
no, they don't do that.
So I was like, right. So I wrote this story about this guy, right? So 20 years later, I get an email, a Facebook message saying, I need you to verify that I was at 9/11 because he was trying to get compensation, right?
Right.
And I thought, what if, now we're getting into fiction land, we're moving away from the reality. What if you called me and said, I need you to verify I was there because I was accused of a crime. I've been arrested and I'm going to trial, but you saw me, you saw me. And I thought, oh, that's so good. Like 25 years ago, you're his alibi in a newspaper that's not digitized. Like how are you going to, And of course, it would be much more complicated than that when you start to write the story. Like maybe he isn't innocent.
Right.
But then I thought that has nothing to do with Bethesda. That has nothing to do with moms. Like that's the kind of idea I get and I go, I can't use that. Like, I don't know how I'm going to shoehorn that into the suburbs. Like that's right. But so I get tons of ideas. I have to say, this is not going to work for kind of where I'm in my career right now.
Let me ask you something then, and this is and I was speaking of Crime Reads. I was talking to Molly Odens, who was one of the editors of Crime Reads, and other people about this, with domestic suspense or domestic noir and these relationships. It never seems to be. I mean, there's some aspects of that here, but it never seems to be an upstream thing from child to parent. And it never seems to be a vertical thing where horizontal thing. I said I'm going like this and I'm saying vertical. A vertical, horizontal thing among siblings or something like that. It becomes almost like literary fiction. The minute you get out of the suburbs and, you know, either sexual or marital relationships and other kinds of things, or top down parent to child having a secret, it seems to float out of the crime fiction realm. I mean, what if your brother and sister are harboring this secret and you all live in the suburbs? What if it's your mom or your dad's? God, my mom, fucking killed or was lured this girl in so her friends from so-and-so prep could rape her during beach week, back in 1985.
No, I think there are some domestic thrillers that do, especially sister relationships.
Right.
Because it has to be a close, intimate relationship.
Right.
And there are some ones that are based on families. I think so. But, it has to be kind of in the domestic sphere, like day-to-day life. It has to be part of ordinary life, a break from ordinary life, right?
So is that...
There are a few that do that, yeah.
So in other words, if you were working on something like that, it would have to be the protagonist, I guess, would be the kid. The parents would have to be in close proximity, or your siblings.
Yeah.
Would have to be living in the same neighborhood as you or something like that.
Yeah, and I've done that in some of my books. Like the book I just finished, I just turned it in to my editor. It's about a mother with secrets and her grown daughter who's cleaning out her house and is kind of discovering stuff.
Now this, I'm going to get to that, but this is historical fiction though, right? Is it?
It has a strain. It has a dual timeline, and one of the timelines is 1974, 1975.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I was just, curious about the other stuff. I mean, other kinds of relationships, and I'm not a big aficionado of the subgenre, but I know a little bit about it, and I haven't really seen a lot of real, bottom to top, child to parent, and then sibling kind of relationships. And those are the first relationships in our lives.
And I've seen a lot of sisters books. I haven't seen a lot of sister brother books. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think that that is the sister thing, that that is a function of agents and publishers because they know women, you know, probably, you know,
and there's something
kind of sister thing.
I don't have a sister, but there's definitely something about sisters.
Yeah.
Right.
I observe it. Trust me. My wife and my sister-in-law have the most dysfunctional sister relationship I've ever seen in that.
Do you want to put this on the podcast?
Well, no, here comes the punchline, because they absolutely adore and respect one another.
Right. But I think Alfred Burke had a book called like The Better Sister or The Good Sister.
Yeah,
I know Sally Hepworth had a book called The Good Sister. So I do think sisters is a domestic thriller theme.
Yeah. Yeah. But they have to, it's definitely like one's an alter ego of the other kind of a thing.
Right.
And you definitely don't see it with brothers and sisters, because again, that definitely, what that does, that floats it into literary fiction, because every book I've ever read where the sister's a protagonist and the brother has trouble, it's probably literary fiction and it's got all these other broader themes. You know,
now you're making me want to write a brother sister book. Yeah, I have a brother. I could write a brother sister book.
I mean, they love that. I know I would. I can't put my sister in any of my books. You know, she's already, that's verboten for me. But let me get to some technical kind of craft questions. Your books do really well in audio, and what kind of experience is that? Because with domestic suspense, I'm going to assume, and here I'm totally talking out of my ass, I'm going to assume that you're going to need more than one actor or voice person for these.
Never had more than one. Always had one.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. So here's the story of my audiobooks. I hope I don't get in trouble for saying this.
Oh, no.
My third book, Such a Lovely Family, the publisher forgot to do the audiobook.
Oh my God.
It was a couple of weeks before the book was coming out, and I asked them about it and they said they'd forgotten to do it. And it was Macmillan, and Macmillan said they weren't going to do it.
Wow.
And so we got back the audio rights and we sold them to Tantor, which is one of the kind of independent audio people, and they made the audiobook. And then for my fourth book, You Deserve to Know, they said, we don't want to do audio at all. So we said, okay. Again, we sold it to Tantor.
Yeah.
And that became an Audible bestseller.
Yeah.
So for
I was wondering,
because
when you look at it listed, it says Tantor instead of
right.
Yeah.
And now for the fifth book, they did the Audible again. They did, Macmillan did want it. So.
Oh, okay. Let's just play with this. Why, as an uninformed person, would I think that you would need more than one? Because I figured, you know, you have multiple characters,
right?
And you do have a lot of male characters.
Oh, you know what? One of my books, You Deserve, All the Dirty Secrets, had two narrators. It had a teenager and an older woman.
Okay. Yes.
I think it's very common in romance. They often have. And I think they're moving in that direction in general. But I haven't had, except for that one book, I haven't had that before. For All the Dirty Secrets had two narrators. But I think my next book, since it does have a male point of view, it will have to have, I'd like it to have more than one narrator.
And then you're going back into the 70s too. I mean, with that.
Yeah.
They would have to. Okay. Yeah. So I was wondering about that, because, you know, again, you have audio bestsellers, and it must be hard for one person to take, to take that burden on. Have anybody ever asked you to do it yourself?
God, no, I could never do that. I could never do it. My last two books have a really good narrator named Alex Picard. She's really great. She's done a really good job. I tell you, Chris, that I was doing an Audible original?
No. Well, please promo that.
Yeah. So that's called The Gift House, and that I'm working on it right now, the edits. And I think it's coming out at the end of the year, beginning of the new year. Okay. And so it'll just be on Audible, and it's really true domestic thriller.
Wow.
Just like straight heroin, like just nothing else. Just like you're in the suburbs and things are crazy.
Are you going to get the same person to narrate, to read?
So this is all through Audible. So they do their own production. Yeah. Oh my gosh. And I think they do a full cast. It's a male point of view, a stalker male, and a young wife in the suburbs. And so I think they're going to do a full cast.
That sounds like my kind of story.
it's pretty dark. Yeah.
good. That's up more up my alley. I was lucky enough for my Audible books that the actor was actually an actor on The Wire. And
He
was able to do a lot of the vernacular and everything and different characters really well. It would have probably been nuts. But where do you see yourself? Because we're going to go into the TV stuff now. I mean, do you see yourself down the line retiring from this and trying to become a producer or a showrunner or something like that?
Not at all. I think my retirement plan is to find a series I'd like to write. It's like the downshift into some world that I want to be in for like 10 years and write a series.
Oh, okay. Well, what about, this journey now? I mean, Vampire Diaries people, that's a good get.
It's amazing. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about what that journey was like. I mean, was it painless or painful, or can you say?
I think I just got really lucky that there's a producer out in LA who likes my books, and he optioned my first four books, and he's just been working really hard. His production company has been working really hard for years now. Just, we got close with something at Peacock for my first book. It didn't happen. Right. My third book's at Netflix. I don't know if it's going to go anywhere or not. And this one just, happened. And it's really all because of him and his like dedication to them. I really didn't do anything, Chris. I wrote the book, but yeah.
But what would happen if, they decided, we want to go in this direction in a series, but, we don't want you to write the books first. We want you to give us the ideas to write the scripts to follow up. I mean, would you do that?
Does that happen? I know
sometimes,
nothing.
Apparently, sometimes it does.
Yeah.
I don't know in our genre, but I think in others it does. And stuff like that.
Yeah. I've made myself pretty clear that I don't really want anything to do with Hollywood. Not like in a negative way, but it's just, I don't know anything about it. I don't actually watch that much TV, like a little here and there. And these people are pros. They do it all the time. They know everything. And I'm thrilled that they've optioned my books, but I don't want to be involved.
Do you get any sneak peek? No, I don't blame you. But do you get any sneak peek of how it's going to go? I mean, are you nervous that oh crap, it's going to totally change? I mean, I have a friend who is pretty big in horror, Victor Laval, and he's got a lot of stuff in option. And, a lot of his books, they change the end, to make it a little either more palatable or... many times, the monster is us in the mirror, and they're like, right. "Well, no, that's not a good payoff for the audience. That's to be a real monster."
Right.
And he sits back and kind of takes it.
Yeah.
I mean, are you nervous that you're going to be like, oh no, what are they going to do?
I've seen the treatments for a couple of my things, and they do change things. And at that point, I just go, okay, I'm out. Like, they really know their medium in a way that I don't. So what works in a book might not work in a series. And so I just have let go of all expectations. I'm just happy that other people are inspired by something I've written. But like, honestly, if they did like an interpretive dance, that'd be okay. Like whatever they do is fine.
And to our listeners, this is why I wanted this woman on the podcast, because you just heard a very earnest and honest answer, because usually people I talked to were like, oh, yes, well, you know, I was thinking about becoming the showrunner, and the producer had asked me, and I'm thinking, you know, you go into this, they go into this whole kind of like, yeah, this was preordained kind of thing. Some of these people that I hang out with it, you know, at the Edgars or Thriller Fest, I'm not going to name any names, but you know, it is interesting to see your work up there. But what about the casting, though? I mean, you're probably more emotionally invested in that, though, right?
I'm not.
Really? Okay.
I feel like a huge disappointment to you. I just don't care.
You've just
care.
Blown all my questions now.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see what they do with it. But, you know, I'm very weird this way in that as soon as I'm done with the project, I'm done. I'm ready to move on to the next project. Maybe it's from being a newspaper reporter. Like, I just don't think about my past projects that much. They're almost like little parasites in my brain I have to get out. And once they're out, I move on to the next thing in my brain. And now, as I'm wrapping up book number 6, I'm thinking, like, what am I going to do for book number 7?
Right.
Like, I just keep moving forward. I don't look back at those books.
It's interesting. Your answer is right. Because when I talk to a lot of people, I mean, I'm talking about even friends of ours, mutual friends of ours. The one thing they do kind of get, I wouldn't say, you know, maybe I shouldn't have said emotionally invested, but the one thing they do get kind of keyed about is casting. And like, they see this person and you were like, yeah, it's just another thing. You know, I got to finish this manuscript. And, you know, which is interesting.
Well, I know what I'm good at and it's not casting.
Yeah. So, but
don't you think, Chris, that some people we know as writers get too caught up in the books that they wrote?
Yeah, probably. Yeah,
and ought to turn their attention towards the future and what the next thing is. You know,
yes, they do. They do. They should. I mean, they say they do, but I think I don't know. Maybe a lot of it is when I talk to a lot of people, it doesn't matter. It's down the line. You know, I mean, even when I was talking to Todd Robinson and Rob Hart, I mean, everybody has a certain amount of imposter syndrome, and you deal with it in whatever way you can, and it can come out in various weird ways, and it's not necessarily negative or awful. It's just, you know, but I chalk it up to a lot of people just kind of like, God, I'm really doing this. This is really happening. But, you know, and so they deal with it in weird ways. But most people should move on to what
I mean,
know,
I have
the
like
next
a
thing.
Anxiety that I'm not going to get to write all the things I want to write before I die or before I start to lose my marbles. Like, I feel the pressure. You know, I'm not 25. Like, I need to get this stuff done.
Oh, I do too. And I'm in my 60s now. I just, you know, I'm now dipped my toe into just now into, you know, decrepitude. And, you know, I worry about that too. But then I see some of the people who are out here just letting it go. And I mean, including my idols like Pelicanos or Dennis Lehane or Jim Grady, you know, people like that. And, but it's interesting.
I guess what I'm just saying is, like, I don't have time to worry about casting. Like, that's just not what I'm focusing on.
Okay.
At all,
no. You know? That's a great answer. Great answer. So we're going to be wrapping up soon, but I just wanted to ask in that regard. I mean, in addition to the new one and then the Audible stuff, what kind of things, you know, do you have also floating around out there? Do you have other genres that you're thinking about?
I do have a passion project which I talk about, which I haven't really done anything. I have about 40,000 words on it, but I'd one day like to write a historical mystery series. That's I really am passionate about, based on Long Island in the 1920s, sort of the Gatsby era, the Gold Coast, Prohibition, that, you know, the organized crime. Did you know, I mean, you probably know this, but did you know that in you know, the Jewish and Italian gangs that ran like New York in the 1910s and stuff, when Prohibition was enacted in 1920, they called a meeting and said, let's organize, let's not be competing gangs. And that's where organized crime comes from just these people sitting down and saying, you know, we should organize.
Let's not just burn down stuff and kill each other. Let's do it. Yeah, because a lot of those guys where like the gangster movies, I don't think do the history right, because there were established, you know, during World War One and like even right before it, established Jewish and Italian gangs, and those guys became the mentors to the, you know, Meyer Lansky's, and you know, Meyer Lansky was like 18 and learning from these guys, and those were the guys, these were the guys that, you know, Fitzgerald based Meyer Wolfsheim on these older guys. Wolfsheim wasn't based on Lucky Luciano. He was based on Luciano's, you know, their mentor.
Yeah. Right.
You know, if the great Gatsby was set now, Gatsby would probably be a crypto banker. You know, he was just a money launderer. But no, that would be a great series. It's just, you know, but this is begging my next question. Do you think our industry has the balls or the chops to continue to support, you know, your imagination like that? I was at a book event that you gave, and I think it was one of our compatriots, Ed Amar, was asking you about stuff, and you gave this really crazy ass chilling answer about how the top books on Amazon are unabashedly written by AI, and the people eat it up like it's no big deal. I mean, is that going to be our fate before you can put pen to paper on this historical thing? What do you think about that?
Yes, I think the ground is moving underneath us as we speak. I think our industry is changing as we speak and will not look the same in 5 years.
Wow. And that's
and not, I don't know. I don't know what else you can do. But here's the thing. And maybe I'm being optimistic, but as long as there are boomers and Gen Xers who want to read real books, like maybe there are younger people who want that too. Yeah. Like my son reads like Dostoevsky and Camus and Stephen King. He doesn't read, you know, AI generated stuff.
It seems to be that gap. And then you've got the Gen Alpha people are like, yeah, I want paper to read.
Yeah, my son's Gen Z, but he wants paper. The other day he was walking around, you know, one pocket, he had like a worn out copy of Night by Elie Wiesel in his pocket the whole trip we took. You know, it was great. But you have to be realistic. You know, you're going to be writing for a shrinking audience. They might be a more passionate audience. They might be a more engaged audience. But yes, it will be a shrinking audience. Things are going to change really dramatically in the next 5 years. And anybody who says that it's not happening is just totally fooling themselves.
Do you think that our, you know, crime fiction world is a little less affected by that? That might be like to say the literary authors might fall first. I mean, or do you think we're all going down the tube?
I think it's going to be almost like personal brand. Like if you have a connection, if they think you're a real person putting out real books.
Right.
Right. But then there are people who honestly don't care. They just want a fast-paced thriller and they don't care if AI helped write it. I mean, I don't want to name names, but there are some writers out there who we suspect are already doing this. And I don't think it's going to matter in 5 to 10 years. I think there'll always be purists.
Right.
But I think we have to accept that AI is coming for our jobs.
Okay.
What do you think? What do you think? Do you disagree?
I think it's true. No, I think to some extent, I think that is true to some extent. I mean, I think here's the thing. I do believe, however, that there is going to be a gap. And that's why I mentioned Gen Alpha, not with your son Gen Z, but there is going to be a backlash at some point. And I think that, you know, as long as we keep hitting on the fact that this is not genuine, that this is disingenuous, you know, the moguls that are in charge of that, you know, they have to answer it somehow. So they either have to smash us to pieces, and they can't do that, or they're going to have to hide behind more layers. I really don't think there are enough, you know, romanticy people out there who really genuinely believe that they can get that kind of enjoyment out of a non-human, because at some point, you know, even the algorithm's going to start repeating itself, and it's going to be garbage, and then it's going to have to come back to us.
I was talking about this with a mutual friend of ours, Ilana, the other day about how, like, in the, you know, you look at the big books that were huge in the 90s, let's say Jonathan Franzen or something, right? Like, right. In the 90s, there are all these gatekeepers. In the 80s, all these tastemakers. And that was terrible for some reasons and obviously really hard. But those editors and those gatekeepers, they had specific tastes. Like, they said, these are good books. Here, right. America, you have to go read them. We do have a different system now. We have what's the most popular book? What's the most well-liked book? Right. How can we be more liked? And being liked is actually a different thing from being good, right? So we have a different incentive system set up right now. Yeah. And as long as the incentive is just to be super popular and to be the most liked, right, that incentivizes AI.
Yeah. Well,
I know I'm a real buzzkill. Sorry.
No. But it's okay. No, but I mean, this is great, and you know, I'm actually glad we did end on that, because it keeps people, you know, it gives you a realistic taste of what's going on. But you know, you have a fan base already, and these people, you know, from what I have noticed, you know, your fan base is not in a nursing home.
It's so, quite diverse, yeah, age-wise, race-wise, yeah. Everything. Like, really interesting people read my book, like a real wide array.
This might carry us, you know, and that's the hopeful part there. You know, I'm although, again, yeah, you're right. I have this notion of human AI. I know that sounds kind of bizarre, but my version of human AI is very well-known, you know, well-read in terms of, you know, everybody knows who they are and, you know, putting out work that gets optioned all the time, just coasting.
Right.
And just coasting, putting out the same kind of product. And they almost become soap operas with murder, basically. Right. And, you know, is that any worse than an algorithm writing the book? And, you know, and I think, no, I don't like an algorithm writing the book, but it's pretty close. And my thing is, we're already there with that,
right?
And I think that's a sad that's sad about the industry now. Is it, you know, those writers, you know, they're incentivized to almost become an algorithm themselves,
in other right? words.
Just boom, 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 and people will just buy it. Because you're right, they want to read something on the train, or they want to read something in the chaise lounge. And
I do think that most readers want some kind of connection with the author.
Right.
Right. They like that. They're interested, like, in that. Like, I think people are interested in Ilana because she was a former CIA spy.
Right.
Maybe they're interested in my experiences because I was a cops reporter. They're interested in you because you grew up, right, you know, about DC. And I think finding out that AI wrote it just kills that. It just...
Yeah. Well, all of us should go into romantasy and write about, you know,
I can't
sex
do
with
it.
A unicorn.
Oh, my friends call that uniporn. Yeah.
Uniporn. I like that. They didn't copyright that, did they? Because I wouldn't use that. Well, we have just had a great, great conversation with Aggie Blum
Thompson. Yeah, thanks, Chris.
It has been a pleasure and an honor. And, you know, you are... you know, as the guy said at the end of the party in Trading Places, it was a stone groove. You are the most righteous. but I mean, I'm not being fawning or weird here. I mean, you are an exemplar of what this subgenre is and what it could be. And this shift from, you know, domestic suspense, which is became a kind of a weird kind of a marketing thing, to real domestic noir, and you know, and it is a pillar, as I said before at the beginning, of our general crime fiction world.
Yeah, it's one of the tentpoles. It really is.
Thank you so much for sharing.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you all. Check us out: Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and of course, ChrisChambersNoir.com. I'm Hope Katz Gibbs. Thank you, Aggie. That was fascinating. I'm with you on AI. I have a newspaper for kids, by kids, about kids, and it's an AI-free zone. So we're going to try and teach these kids to use their brains.
Yeah.
And so keep carrying the torch. I can't wait to watch your show on Hulu.
Yeah.
All right, everybody. We'll see
you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Chris Noir. Take good care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.